Hey, everybody. Big news from our friends at the New Republic. Their Stop Trump Summit is making a stop right here in Philadelphia, the home of unreasonable and the birthplace of American democracy. You know, that system we cherish that Trump and his acolytes are determined to burn to the ground. If you listen to Unreasonable, then you're no stranger to the New Republic and its landmark reporting. In fact, if you remember our very first episode, we had a conversation with journalist Nina Burley, who previewed her TNR cover story on Leonard Leo, Barry's side, and the dark money fueling the radical right. The Stop Trump Summit focuses on how America ended up in this dangerous place, how Trump could use the government against its own people should he be reelected, and what laws and policies are at stake. The Stop Trump Summit will be held live at Liberty View at Independence Visitor Center in Philadelphia on Saturday, May 18th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Among the featured speakers are Mary Trump, Rick Wilson, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, Molly Jong-Fast, host of the popular Fast Politics podcast, as well as locals Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, David Cohen, professor at Drexel Klein School of Law, and PA State Senator Vincent Hughes, plus many others. It's an event you won't want to miss. It'll be nothing if not cathartic, and it may even inspire you to action. You know, here at Unreasonable, action is kind of our thing. For tickets, go to tnr.com/events. There's also a link on our events page, podcastunreasonable.com/events. This threat to American democracy and the future of our country must be stopped. Coming out of the Stop Trump Summit in Philadelphia is a great place to start. And now on to our show.
That night of the election, I had one of the worst parties in the world, like many people. You know, most of my parties, people don't collapse on the couch crying, thank God. But as the red spread over the map, I kept on saying the word no.
I wonder how many of you have been frustrated, mystified, or otherwise intimidated by the refrain, just get involved. It's like the next level of just go vote. And if you've been listening to Unreasonable for a while, you know that we and our guests are nothing if not consistent that getting involved is the only antidote to the toxicity that is white Christian nationalism and the MAGA movement that has become its latest vessel. But what does getting involved actually mean? Though some of you are lifelong activists, campaign professionals, candidates for public office, or even elected officials, others of you are brand new to this world. You're listening to this show now. I tell you, go get involved. What do you do? It's abstract, right? Difficult to relate to. Work that someone else will take care of. Easily dismissed. I'm your host, David Brown, joined by my co-host, Christina Iacono. And actually, I'm selling ourselves a little bit short for the sake of argument, because we do go out of our way to enumerate and elucidate the ways that you can convert your passion about an issue that we discuss into sheer grassroots power through activism. But today's episode, I think, is particularly meaningful in this way, because we're tracking the work, strategy, trajectory, successes of, and most importantly, available opportunities provided by a relatively new organization that has been making civic engagement waves across our country since its inception in 2020. I'm talking about Field Team 6. They may not be the ones who got bin Laden, but they certainly went a long way to keep the orange terrorist out of the White House 4 years ago. And they've got a plan this time around, too. Their methodology? Voter registration. Laser-focused, person-to-person, targeted, partisan voter registration. We're talking to Jason Berlin, Executive Director of Field Team 6, an organizer who transferred his considerable party political savvy into a new and, again, highly effective, desperately needed organizing model that registers approximately one voter for every dollar donated to the organization. Yeah, let that sink in for a minute. One voter per dollar. If you're a seasoned activist, you're going to want to learn about how Jason made this happen. And if you've never taken that first step to get involved, I have a feeling that today is your day. Field Team 6, I believe, is going to be your foray into making change. Making certain that pro-democracy, pro-abortion, pro-environment, pro-church-state separation candidates succeed across the country this November. Our work continues, and perhaps yours begins, on today's episode of Unreasonable. Yours is sort of an unlikely personal trajectory, I think, from TV writer and producer to executive director of Field Team 6. Can you walk us through your career that led you to activism?
Yeah, absolutely. So, thank you for having me here. I was a TV writer for 18 years. It was mainly reality, comedy, and where they crossed over. Wipeout was probably the biggest show I've written for, fat people falling into water or mud. I wrote the jokes for that show.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. I was a huge political junkie for many years. And it was only when Trump got elected, though, in 2016, that it really broke my mind and heart, and I needed to change my life. Like, thankfully, so many people across the country. So I gave up my TV writing career.
It's very brave.
It really was all I wanted to do, just organizing before I even knew that it was organizing, really just weaponizing my extroversion, you know? Nice. So that night of the election, I had one of the worst parties in the world, like many people, you know, most of my parties, people don't collapse on the couch crying. Thank God. But as the red spread over the map, I kept on saying the word no. I couldn't believe it was happening. And just kept thinking about my mom, who I'm super close to, who's a, you know, loved the Obamas like I did, and could not stand the idea that this could ever happen. And I kept thinking about the Obamas and just repeating the word no. And something really snapped. And about 3 months later, early February, I think it was, there was this new group called Swing Left, and they were holding meetings all over LA. Yeah.
Yep.
And the one closest to me was sold out. It was free, but it was sold out. No more room. And that was happening all over the country. Like, I'd find out later, but I managed to get into one in Chinatown. Almost didn't go because I'm not going to know anybody, you know, the normal excuses. I forced myself to go. And as soon as I was in the room, this shitty artist's loft downtown, sorry if the person who owns the loft is listening. It wasn't that shitty. It was just an artist's loft. Okay. It was standing room only, and just being around so many people who felt as insane as I did, it felt like the only place I could really be sane. You know, it was so transformative immediately. Just all these people taking time out of their lives, stuffing themselves into this room because it was so important to do whatever they could to fight. And Swing Left had just formed. I had so many questions and I asked them all, and there were very few answers because this really was a true grassroots uprising. You know, we had come together faster than that organization planned for sure, and had the ability to channel us into positive action.
You were on the West Coast, right? So you're in California. Yeah, and this is
exactly.
And this is basically this conglomeration of everyone getting together and just forging an activist alliance was the best thing that you could do at that point.
Absolutely.
I need to know, like, how a career in Hollywood in TV production prepares you for democratic organizing. I'm assuming that there's a lot that goes into a TV production. And did that give you a special background that makes you a real good fit for what you're doing now?
In conjunction with your weaponized extroversion.
It strangely was the perfect training for organizing. You know, like when people talk about organizing, they're like, oh yeah, it's not much pay. It's long hours. It's nothing compared to the abuse you suffer in the entertainment industry. It's like, just the level of abuse really prepares you for organizing well. But besides that, writing is just a crucial ability. You always need that in organizing. And I had done some stand up too. That also helps, especially in times that are so serious. If you have the ability to crack even a bad joke, people are so grateful.
Right. The presence of some levity.
Totally.
It can be a pretty dark field otherwise.
Definitely. So you need that to keep yourself alive. But really, it was so meaningful to be part of that group. A guy named Christian Espirius, who had won awards for registering voters, doing partisan voter registration, registering Democrats for the Obama campaign and for the Obama reelect. He started giving workshops around LA County in how to hold your own partisan voter drives. I heard him speak. He was amazing. I followed him around like a Grateful Dead groupie. Went to like three of the same workshop three times, but just mustered the courage, got the patter under my skin, and got a couple of friends from my swing left chapter to go with me on my first voter drive up to a swing district just north of LA. Steve Knight was the Republican, the congressman representing the area at the time. Katie Hill was running against him. And yeah, we went up to a courthouse and we registered a few people. It worked. Like proof of concept has actually worked, you know?
Oh, it's so fulfilling.
It's super, super satisfying. Yeah. You're talking to young people, people of color, women mainly. These are the people who are registering, who are disenfranchised, or who have, you know, 60% of people who are not registered to vote have never been asked. So
that's compelling.
That's heartbreaking, right? But also it's our opportunity to help. So we ask. That's what we do. So then we started competing against each other for numbers, how many people we could register, and competing against ourselves. And that really putting some competition in it, gamifying it, made it even more fun. And I was totally addicted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was doing a financial free fall this whole time, of course, because, you know, this is all volunteering, you know, over a year. And
oh, I can relate so hard.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. And right. As organizers, you know, you don't go into organizing to get rich.
My background's in classical violin playing and composing. So I did not set out in my life to get rich in the first place. I consider that my political superpower.
Yeah, that is a superpower to have a high threshold for financial insecurity.
Yeah. That's it. That's the line.
That's what keeps most people out. You know, yeah, that is a superpower. So eventually, though, I needed a job. So I figured out, well, I actually got a job doing customer service for a real estate company, just like part-time so I could keep my, subsidize my organizing, and figured out the exact minimum amount I would need from a job to survive. And the California Democratic Party had an opening for an organizer, a LA County organizer. And I applied to that and I interviewed super hard. You know, they heard the fire in my belly. And most people they hire are half my age, but they're like, all right, this weird old guy needs to do this. Okay. And they hired me for the exact amount, exact minimum amount I had determined I needed to survive. You know, it was actually less than that because they wound up not paying for clipboards or pens.
Oh my stuff God.
Like, that. Yeah. Like yeah. A teacher, you've got to bring your own supplies.
Exactly like that. Exactly. But I was totally ecstatic. Then they hired another organizer. They figured, you know, LA County, biggest county in the country, 10 million people. So two. Hired two organizers. Mm-hmm. That should be good. 5 million each. Michael Tinetti was his name. And he remains one of my best friends. Super, super hard worker. We quickly started doing more voter drives. We realized we were kind of left to our own devices in this job. So we thought, let's max it out, do the most we possibly can. And we were holding four voter drives a week in multiple districts. There were five swing districts in Southern California at the time, including all of Orange County and the one north of us. So we were doing four voter drives a week and holding about at its height, it was between 15 and 20 phone banks a week as well.
Wow.
You know, that we would train people and spin them off all over the county. They'd be doing these. Yeah. And we wound up registering about 6,000 Democratic voters and helping do our part to flip those five districts in 2018, you know, and take back the House.
Those are truly amazing numbers all around. not the least of which is the number of phone banks that you were hosting in a week. That is a ton of work. That is a ton of work. And like high stress work too, because you are managing myriad volunteers and people dealing with technical issues. I mean, that's hard. That is hard work. Just have to put a fine point on that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah, it was. It's so, so satisfying. As you know, organizing is it's a people job. You're just bathed in people all day, you know, different personalities. And yeah, it's so fun. I love it. I'm an introvert turned extrovert. I was super shy as a kid. So
interesting.
Yeah. So I'm kind of extroverted.
What led to you and Michael forming Field Team 6 and going national with this work?
Yeah, yeah. So we did that work for the 2018 midterms. The results that came in. It was like political Hanukkah because California counts so slow that it was like every few days, oh, another district, well, you know, flipped.
It's a miracle.
And I remember being in a Trader Joe's when I found out the fifth out of the five districts we were working on flipped. The final one, Gil Cisneros won it, and just weeping openly in public. It was so good. So that's the proudest work I've ever been a part of. And the day after or so, the 2018 midterms, my job ended with the party. And that was as it was planned to do, as routine, as you know, and also insane. Insane.
Oh, I have all kinds of thoughts about that. I'm sure we share them.
Yeah. And so that's why a few weeks later, it was Michael's idea. He was like 25 at the time. You know, I was smart enough to know an amazing idea. And we decided there needs to be a place where institutional knowledge can accumulate, where we break the cycle of pain, this constant churn, where we just learned 1,000 important esoteric lessons that no one else knows about voter registration. And that was just going to be thrown in the garbage. That seemed ridiculous. It seemed like a bad time to break up the band, this passionate core group of a few hundred volunteers that we had. So this was a way to keep it going. You know, Field Team 6 was a play on SEAL Team 6, who got bin Laden, because we're the crack voter registration group who goes behind enemy lines in these purple districts and states and does the impossible.
I love it.
You know, registered Democrats save the world became our slogan and our mission. And we decided to go national to see like what kind of good trouble we could get into on a big scale.
I find it so intriguing that you're talking about several things related to the viability of a career in party organizing. And I've said for a long time that I think the Democratic Party should be hiring regional organizers in perpetuity. These people gain that institutional knowledge. They develop trust with regional organizations. And most of all, they have personal career viability because they would be retained and could consider making this region their place of employment indefinitely. And all the benefits that come with that knowledge, with that comfort level, with that sense of connection to community. So one of the things I wanted to ask you out of the gates, and you've already answered it effectively, was how important it was to you to be able to do your own thing, because it can be so frustrating to organize within a party institution. I've always felt that way working for certain candidates or party leaders or consultants or stakeholders. Mm-hmm. It's so convoluted. Yeah. Would you share with us if there were any other motivating factors or demotivating factors about working within another institution that inspired you to set out on your own path? What are some other obstacles that you were able to overcome by creating Field Team 6?
Well, first of all, chef's kiss is what I say to you about that idea. We're having, you know, long-term organizers on the ground, regional organizers. That's an amazing idea. That's absolutely, that would be so helpful, you know, and that would counter the cliche of the, you know, the party parachuting someone in, the DCCC parachuting someone in from some other part of the country, telling people what to do,
right,
instead of deferring to the people on the ground who know their voters better than anyone. I think that's a great idea. That's good organizing. So the California Democratic Party now is under different management than when I worked for it, a better management.
Oh.
And they actually do have so-called forever organizers.
That's wonderful.
Who are kind of the regional organizers that you're describing.
Are you listening, Pennsylvania?
Other states take note.
Yeah, it was a good development. You know, really, it really does help. And they're sharing their mobilized platform online with all the grassroots groups, including Field Team 6. So yeah, it's a much more open to grassroots culture that the Democratic Party now in the state has. When I worked for it, I said, hey, we have to buy a printer. You know, they were like, oh, we have a printer. It's in West LA. That's like maybe an hour drive for me from where I was. You can go print stuff there. Like, oh, what? Oh. That was just, you know, they actually, they hated me because I kept on asking for the money they said they would have given me for clipboards and pens.
and
just raising that question made them not like me so much. But so it was really important to have an organization that's separate from the party, where we could make our own decisions and be nimble, have no bureaucracy, make decisions quickly, keep communication lines open always from the top to the bottom. You know, every volunteer has a line of communication for the good of the organization, so we can harvest the best ideas that our genius volunteers regularly have and put them into practice. That is why we're so effective. It's just because of all the combined brain power and heart of all the volunteers, you know?
Grassroots power. It's the essence of it.
Yeah, that's where all the energy is. And so we revere our volunteers. So there were many obstacles to overcome in becoming a national organization, you know, just because in the beginning, you're just saying we're a national organization, but it's not true yet. It's just an idea and you're just a delusional person. it was just a matter of like how many people.
Aspiring care. National organizations.
Yeah. That's a nicer way to say it. There has to be that stage for anything to, you know, any national organization to begin. It was just a matter of how many people I could talk to and email and Zoom with any given day to expand our operation. So we managed to get chapters going in swing states across the country. And we were an all in-person voter drive organization at that point. And then early 2020, COVID hit. And we immediately had to pull all our voter drives off the calendar all across the country and could have gone under easily. We adapted, you know, as quickly as we could. We were incredibly lucky that we had the money by that point. We were broke the entire first year. 2019 broke the entire year. You know, we'd have a backyard party a friend would throw. We'd raise enough money to like go above zero, just above zero. Oh, and then go back on my credit card. You know, mid-2020, maybe early 2020, we started pulling up above zero. We were able to hire someone, Dale Roy Robinson, who's now our COO. We only have three people on paid staff, including me and Dale.
That's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, we have over 100 volunteer staff who lead over 20 different specialized teams.
Wow.
And over 20,000 volunteers across the country now. We've grown.
That is
a
testament to how you treat your volunteers. To your point, you say you revere them. That's the evidence.
Well, they come for the cause and stay for the people because it's the best group I've ever been associated with. It's a huge honor. I work in a hero rich environment, you know, wonderful people all day. Yeah. Like it's so therapeutic. But yeah, so we almost went under because of COVID, but instead, Dale was key to this. Also, Corey, the third person on payroll out of three. Corey had come from Mayor Pete's presidential campaign. He is a super brain. And he and Dale together were able to figure out how to talk to the biggest political data vendors in the country, Catalyst, Civitech, Target Smart, a few others. And we started raising money and bought our first list, a list of college students who were unregistered and considered likely Democrats, and then bought a list of Black women, then raised more money, bought a list of Black men, Latino community, you know, raised more money, got a list of same-sex marriage supporters, purged voters, and list by list built this amazing, unique in the country database of what's now millions of unregistered people who are likely Democrats.
That is so valuable.
So, so valuable. That's our secret weapon. And that's our basis for all digital outreach, including emails, texting, postcards, and phone banking.
Yeah.
And that's turned out to be super, super effective. You know, we brought back the in-person voter drives. We're still doing those. And in addition, we're doing all this data-driven outreach. So our goal for 2020 was to, our really aspirational goal was to register 100,000 new voters. And we didn't hit that, but we wound up helping register over 700,000.
Oh my God.
Because that data, that data-driven approach gave us this national wingspan. We could get right to where we needed to be and really fine-tune our focus. You know, we get right to the people we needed to be reaching out to.
I have a question about data And David does a lot of the organizing, and I'm more of the voting wonk end. Like I'm in the nuance of how elections work. And I know that a lot of times third party vendors are buying data that might be a little outdated, and that there are times that from an election advocate perspective, I think that misinformation, I'm not saying that anything is that it's intentional, but misinformation can cause a huge problem. And what do you do with the data that you get to ensure that your organization is not contacting the wrong people, or just that there are glitches? Like, because this is a big issue as we move towards 2024, as we move towards people purchasing lists, both on the left, right, and center. Some of those lists are outdated or may have inaccurate information if they're not coming from the state level pertaining to particularly who is registered to vote. And that always concerns me, because I hate the idea that people are getting information that is lacking or that tells them something that is not true.
Yes, me too. You know, no list is perfect, and voter rolls are usually the databases that for any organization that has access to a database, that's usually what they use. This right. is the opposite of that.
Yeah, that's why I'm so curious about how it works.
It's more difficult to get good data on people who have not registered, because when they register, they fill out all those fields, and you know, you might know their age, their race, all kinds of things about them that you don't beforehand. So what they use to give a partisanship score to each one of these people in the database is age, gender, location. They use some purchase data. So if someone drives a Prius and eats a lot of kale and goes to yoga, it ups the chances. The targeting actually turns out to be good. It's good. In addition to that, so we use screening language because we're a partisan organization. That's our unique niche in the activism landscape.
Especially around voter registration.
Yeah, right. There are very, very few, almost no other voter reg organizations that are partisan. So we are 527, we're a PAC, and that's why we can be as partisan as we like.
Yeah.
It makes it harder to raise money. Common theme in my life coming back, you know, because we're not a 501c3 who, you know, for whom donations are tax deductible, but they're legally bound to be nonpartisan. Our donations to us are not deductible, but they allow us to be openly pro-Democrat. And so we can talk about issues, talk about abortion rights and voting rights and what Biden has accomplished, and tie it to Democrats, and even mention the names of candidates and get that out there, because name recognition is half the battle. So in addition to targeting the likely Democrats to begin with on those lists, we also have screening language. So an outgoing text, for example, might say, in Wisconsin, we believe in access to safe, legal abortion, but MAGA Republicans are trying to crush that freedom. Fight back. Register to vote for Senator Tammy Baldwin and Democrats up and down the ballot. Link to the voter registration page of the Secretary of State. So that screening language acts as Republican repellent. And if the data is a little wobbly in some parts, that shores it up. That helps ensure that the people we want are registering. A Republican, a Trump supporter, could click that link and get registered, but they generally don't.
Yeah, pretty unlikely. Well, I was going to put a fine point on what you're saying about shoring up the data, that it's, I think for a lot of folks who are especially maybe phone banking or text banking, it can be extremely frustrating when it feels like your contact rate isn't good. But if you are inputting the data, if you are responding to this is a wrong number, this is a hostile person, you are tightening that data. So even if it feels like you're not making an impact talking to voters, you are at the very least, in the worst of experiences, phone banking or text banking, you are improving the data set for the organization with whom you are organizing. So it's inherently
right.
useful.
Exactly right. You're cleaning it up for the next pass. Also, what I can say is we've recently finished doing a deep dive on our work in the 22 midterms. We've been around enough to have another midterm come around. We're almost 6 years old. So after an election, We raised the money to compare our entire database. On one side, all the people we reached out to, we know who we reached out to and how many contacts and in what ways. We compare that to the updated 50 state voter rolls. It takes a few months after the election for all the secretaries of state to update the voter rolls. Some are slower than others. Won't name any names, but but we compare those two, and we can see now that in 22, we reached out to 5 million unregistered likely Democrats in swing states, and of those, 1.57 million wound up registering as Democrats or independents, blue or purple voters. Wow. So almost one in three, 31.5%. So,
Jason, that's amazing.
It's amazing. That's a kind of a staggering yield, right? And out of those, 660,000 voted. So it came to 41.8%, which kind of in line with midterm voting, you know, in that year. I think it was 46% across the country.
I have voter turnout issues. That's my
yeah. Talk about that all the time. So I was curious because on your website, there's a beautiful map of the states, the targeted states for 2024. And it's such an interesting mix of red, blue, and swing states. Very pleased that Pennsylvania's is one of them. You've got a list of all your partner organizations within these states as well. What are the criteria for becoming a targeted state with Field Team 6? Is it where you have the strongest partnerships, the best data? What are the criteria?
The criteria are that the state can help us with the big picture goals. And this cycle, the major goal is to win it all. Win it all. Yeah.
Like we all. Need, yep, all as, yep, top to bottom.
We know we're not going to win every election nationwide, but we need to keep the White House, we need to defend the Senate, and we need to take back the House. We need to restore the Democratic trifecta so we can have nice things, so we can pass abortion rights into law nationally, so cases like this crazy one right now with Mifepristone in front of the Supreme Court, we don't need to worry about the insane Supreme Court. Just make it the law of the land. And so we can pass game-changing voting rights that will turn Texas purple overnight and North Carolina and, you know, ungerrymander Ohio, all those things and more. But those are the two.
Man, you're talking the dream.
Yes. That's why we chose those 11 states. We chose specifically California and New York for the House because, you know, we just need a few seats. It's getting lower all the time as Republicans keep retiring from the House, but just need a few seats to take back the House. And California and New York each alone could be responsible for that. I count 6 swing districts in California, 7 in New York or so. You know, we'll see after primaries how it shakes out. We included Montana and Ohio specifically for the Senate because those are our most embattled Democratic senators, John Tester yep. in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio. They're both well-loved for good reason, and it will still be a struggle because their states are getting redder and redder, and all the crazies are going to come out for Trump. So that's 4 states. The other 7 are chosen because they're mainly triple word score states. In other words, at least in some part of the state, every Democrat we register can help us swing a House seat, swing a Senate seat, and flip the state for the White House.
So contrary to what I was suggesting, your targeted states are laser, strategically focused, less than logistically conducive to, you know, what you're capable of doing. That's very impressive. As for a 6-year-old organization that you can make those decisions and execute on them. It's huge.
Thank you. Yeah. It's crazy. 11 states is a lot, but yeah, we choose the states just looking at what we need most to accomplish these huge goals. And that vision, you know, attracts people. It brings in our people, more volunteers show up. And then we try as hard as we can to set up partnerships with groups on the ground in each of these states, because that's just like you were talking about, setting up regional organizers across the country. Our mission is to empower the people who we register to vote, but also to empower the organizations on the ground and always defer to them with every script we write. So for text, bank, postcards, whatever, we write a script, send it to our partner on the ground in, say, Wisconsin, and have them rewrite it from scratch if they want, you know,
I love that.
Like encourage that, because they know the people on the ground better than we ever will. And so defer to them in that.
So your organizations on the ground are rewriting the messaging, but then from a standpoint of at the back end, are you doing messaging polling to look at what works? Like, do you have a PR team that's running comms or that's like giving them guidance saying you can switch it up a little bit, but we know this works? Are you tracking efficacy of different messaging to see what works and what doesn't? Because I'm thinking that if we can all, like, if all of these organizations know, like, hey, this is the messaging that works, then, you know, it seems like that's what the red side does very well. And that's what the blue side is. We're like, we're a big tent. And within that big tent, there are a lot of different things that fall. And sometimes it just doesn't have the same laser focused messaging. So I'm really curious as to how Field Team 6 does that. And if you're tracking efficacy.
Absolutely is the answer. So we do A/B tests whenever we can. We do not have a PR team. That's something we've always needed. Haven't cracked that yet. But what we do have on our volunteer steering committee, the round table, we call it, that meets on Zoom once a week. Patty Crane is a fearsome Jedi on our round table. She ran her own marketing and communications company for 32 years. And she goes to approximately 10,000 hours of webinars a week or so. A little less. She's pulled it back, you know, recently. It was just too much.
But she needs to sleep.
She does, but she's a total gangster.
And ever since she invented time travel and could fit 10,000 hours in per week, damn, it's been
somehow insufferable. She does it. It's insane. It's ridiculous. But she goes to all the cutting edge messaging groups, you know, Anat Shenker Osorio and Simon Rosenberg, and, you know,
one of our friends.
Yes. Michael Podhortzer, all the cutting edge Jen Ancona, Way to Win, Hit Strategies, Terrence Woodbury, all these messaging gurus who are constantly having focus groups, figuring out the best framing, figuring out, okay, freedom. Freedom is how we need to frame these things. You know, Republicans are taking away the freedom to choose, freedom to read the books we like, freedom to love who we love. And, oh, it turns out if we use the word freedoms, plural, that actually tests better. All these really fine points she brings to us every week. And we incorporate that. I'm a writer, you know, lifelong writer. I no script, you know, gets out there without going through me. I mean, I don't mean to overemphasize my role either, because we do have an amazing script lead, Mel Burgess. She's a fantastic writer and puts these scripts together. So,
but I think that is important, because you're a writer who is also an organizer. And it's one thing to be a great writer. It's another thing to understand how to talk to voters. It's another thing to know what it's like to be a volunteer aspiring to talk to voters. So your skill set is actually that kind of ideal synthesis of writing savvy and people skills that I think is kind of rare. So I think it's fair that you that you want to look at all of these before they go out.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you're right. It doesn't matter if you've concocted the most beautiful script if right. It doesn't speak to the voters in their own language. Jose Andres, you know him, World Central Kitchen. Yep. Mm-hmm. I think We Feed People. Is that the documentary about him?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's so good. I was crying throughout that entire documentary. But what reminded me of that is he says, you know, he was in Haiti, I think after the earthquake, and he's making beans, and the local women around him are laughing at him while he's making it. And he's like, what are you laughing at? I own restaurants in five countries, you know? And then he talked to them finally, and they're like, nah, you need to make it more runny. And this is like how the locals like it. And like a good organizer, he deferred to that and learned that huge organizing lesson that you need to speak to people in their language.
I wonder how much messaging is taken from Project 2025. Like, you know, I look at where we are right now and it's so dark. How do you promote optimism? How do you not spread just a blanket message of fear? Like, I look, like if I'm doing messaging, I'm like, oh, here is all the negative things that Project 2025 contains. And people are just like, well, great. I just want to go to bed now.
I'm Christina's optimism coach.
Right. No, it can make you want to just go into fetal position forever.
Yes. So how do you balance, optimism with this the looming fascist autocracy.
That is real. Looming fascist autocracy. It's hard to say it and not sound like a crazy person, but that is exactly literally what is, you know, at our doorstep. That's what we're fighting against. One thing that keeps me centered and doing this from a place of joy is remembering how much we have now that we did not have in 2016. You know, in 2016, AOC was a bartender. You know, Raphael Warnock was a preacher. Biden was like a good former vice president. We didn't think about that much. You know, Congressman Maxwell Frost was in high school.
I hear all that. I hear it, but my uterus has words.
Okay.
And they're angry words. And it's tough. It is really tough to be an optimistic woman in this climate.
I hear your uterus and what I would say to it.
That's something you hear every day.
Didn't think I'd be saying that sentence today. But
whatever.
But what I would say is that abortion rights has been on the ballot 8 times. It has won 8 times in states like Montana, Ohio, Kentucky, and Kansas, where it won by 18 points, right? A landslide.
You've got to remember that.
I do have to remember that. Thank you. My uterus is thankful for that lesson. It needed it today.
Also, Justice Janet Protasiewicz, who flipped the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, she campaigned on abortion rights and gerrymandering, and she won in a 13-point landslide in Wisconsin, where you don't get landslides.
Yes. Oh, and can you remind your peeps in Wisconsin to tell people to vote no on both ballot measures coming up on April 1st?
Right, good.
Yay. Thank you. Yeah. Just my little shout out, because I'm, you know, like...
She follows everyone.
Me too. I'm there.
In Pennsylvania, just looking at our odd year elections, electing judges in 2021, we had 4 seats up for grabs, same in 2023. In 2021, we won 1 out of 4. And last year, we won them all. I mean, that is profound.
Yep.
That is profound, right? I mean, I share your optimism. I mean, our issue again is church-state separation. And I think Republicans overplaying their hand, we talk about this often, is one of the greatest gifts to the Democratic Party. And it's not just Roe, and it's not just bigoted LGBTQIA+ sensationalism, but it's, you know, it's things like Mike Johnson and his appeal to heaven flag that he brandishes outside of his office. Christian nationalism has now entered mainstream discourse. This is becoming something that people understand to fear better, that Christian people can fear better. You know, I think they may be the best players on our team right now, getting crazier and crazier, digging their heels in on insurrection and abortion bans. Meanwhile, Democrats are winning. And that is something that I try to remind everyone around me. I'm inherently optimistic. I understand that. And maybe it's not always realistic, but
that's true. If you don't, I mean, don't look at the polls that come out every week. Look at the ones that matter. The elections, Democrats have won every major battle since Trump got elected in 2016 in a loophole. We won in 2018, 2020, 2022. Turned what was supposed to be a red wave into more of a rosé spritz. And and last year, a string of victories last year. We won, you know, in Virginia and Ohio like crazy. Ohio in the dead of summer. They tried in that special election to pull some chicanery to make it harder to pass abortion rights in November. They thought no one would show up. Everyone showed up. Mm-hmm. It won by 13 points. So if you connect those dots, and even the ones this year, earlier in, looking at my calendar to see what month it is, in February, when we, got Tom Suozzi in, New York's third, replacing George Santos, inventor of electricity and water. that was amazing. So I think that we are in a position to win in a huge way in November. Women are not forgetting. Every time I see an Axios or some article like, has the abortion thing played out? No. What? You don't understand. People don't forget when you take away their basic rights. You know, we're not going back 50 years. Women are, you know, women, young people, people of color, that's the new American majority. And 16 million young people have come of voting age since the 2020 election. I think we're in a position to win big if we do the work. Our goal at Field Team 6 is to raise 3 million, to register 3 million new voters. You know, that's wow. the wow. biggest goal, you know, we've ever had. It's the best value proposition in activism, what we're doing. You know, from what I can see, this adding a new voter for about a dollar, that's, you know, a new blue or purple voter, Democrat or independent. That's exactly what we need the most.
That is such a compelling fundraising metric statistic, you know, that
right?
you can, that is a hell of a pitch.
I don't know any organization that even comes close to that, you know?
Yeah.
And turnout in 2024 is going to be everything. We're going to need every person that registers, that 47% number. I'm still thinking about that, how all of the work, only 47% of the voters actually showed up.
In the midterm, so, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I know it's a midterm. It's like, but I tell people, like, I don't care if they're electing the town coroner or every single election is vital, and we get the representation that we deserve based on what we put in. And if we're not putting in, well, yeah, we're gonna wind up with some real treason weasels on the bench and the ballot. And oh wait, they're already there. I'm in PA.
I think rosé spritz and treason weasels are my favorite terms to come out of this conversation.
It's a good title.
Well, so you mentioned among the demographics about whom you are optimistic, young people. And the conventional wisdom, at least in mainstream media right now, is that young people are overwhelmingly disappointed with Biden around Gaza. They're not going to show up. What are you seeing on the ground? Well, I mean, my argument has been for a while, it's been optimism via pessimism, that we are ascribing a voting diligence to a demographic that traditionally does not vote overwhelmingly, and now getting upset about that. What is your take?
Traditionally, you're right. That's the common wisdom. You know, that's the truth, that they voted a lower rate than other age groups. However, their engagement has been significantly higher since 2018, every election, really. You know,
yeah.
There are studies that show that once you vote in two elections in a row, you become a lifelong voter. Yeah. And that's part of why I think we're sitting on a movement. You know, this is something that's already started growing. They've already started winning elections. And here's another mind-blowing stat. In 2020, turnout among young people in general, 23-27%, depending where you're reading it, turnout among registered young people was 86%.
Yes.
That's
yeah.
Right. Oh my God. That's why I'm in the business of registering new voters. You know, like, because if you register that,
right.
That's why you've seen some measures in a few states to raise the voting age to 21. They are afraid of the voice of the new generation, which could they could outnumber the boomers.
Yeah, absolutely. They already are. At least in population.
Yes.
And that's why in Texas, they're, you know, removing polling stations from campuses, you know, stuff like that.
Texas is ridiculously difficult. They make voter registration so difficult. How does your team on the ground operate in Texas with that? Because Texas is such a difficult state to register to vote. I'm assuming like a big yellow bus that picks people up and actually brings them to the voter registrar's office so that they can do it in person, because otherwise you really never know. You know, it's all like you have to fill out a form, take a photo of your license and actually mail it to the registrars, where they're going to be like, we never got your mail.
You have to be in Texas. This is the only state that does this. In Texas, you have to, in order to register someone else to vote, you have to take a test in your county. And if you pass that test, it enables you to register other people who live in your county only.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, if you want to register someone from other surrounding counties, you have to go to the registrar's office in each of those counties and show them that you passed the test. And then they give you a certificate of reciprocity And then it's insane. They make it so hard. They've raised voter suppression to a masterpiece the way they do it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they stand out, but in general, as you know, the Republican Party, like since before the attack on our capital and the insurrection, the attack on our government, on our democracy, and before and after that, the attack continues on every stage in the life cycle of a voter. They're attacking the entire machinery of democracy. They're attacking, trying to make it harder to register to vote, harder to vote, harder to fairly certify votes. So it gives me hope that some polls recently have shown that democracy is breaking through as an urgent issue to voters, democracy itself.
I hope. I know that the plan in 2024, regardless of the numbers that we come out in, and I push for high turnouts, wide margins. I want the margins to be so big that they are uncontestable. But regardless of what the margins are, they will be contested. It's going to happen.
That is their plan. They're coming out and saying it.
Yep. Right. So
they've been doing it. We know they will. Yeah.
Knowing that, knowing what the plan is for Project 2025, knowing that it seems like just pushing the messaging on that and making sure that we're all aware that, yes, they're going to say this, they're going to do that. But let's look at the reason why they're saying this and how they benefit from it. And let's just take that narrative back and pivot. And, you know, just talking points need to be at the ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just want to point out, we've been speaking for about an hour. I got the text from Bennett saying, oh, you go over if you need to, but which means we're having a really good conversation. But Jason, I would be respectful of your time. And I want to make sure that we talk shop a little bit about how, actually I have it's kind of a question that demands two answers, because I'm curious to know, for anybody listening, how an organization becomes a partner with Field Team 6, and also how individuals can become involved.
Great questions. Thank you. We are always looking for new partners on the ground, wherever you are. We are specifically, you know, focusing on our 11 target states, but we will also help you wherever you are. You know, we're like the A-team, but with far more women. By the way, just since that reminded me, I always try to fit this in. This is a story that's not told at all. And first of all, the media doesn't even know that a resistance exists and that there is this entire activist movement where, you know, Rachel mentions Indivisible once every 2 years or so, and that's about it. In addition to that, most people don't know that the entire progressive movement is about 85% women. You know, that's just a story that's not told at all. So just want to get that in there. That's not just Field Team 6, that's the entire movement.
It's amazing and tragic.
Tragic as far as men not stepping up. Yes, what are we doing?
Yes, right.
Playing video games?
Right.
What are we doing?
Like, do you really not get it? Whatever. Anyway.
We have to fix everything that you guys fuck up. I'm sorry. It's just like, it's.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
Thank you.
And I'm You're sorry. Welcome.
Yeah.
You're doing good work. You get a pass.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Could be
thank
honorary you. Women. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's been rough for ladies lately. Yeah.
Since forever, but also just expecting the first woman president and getting the most misogynist president. Like,
Yeah.
And think about it. We never actually broke into the Capitol and smeared our shit on the wall because of that. We just marched with pink hats. But they're the same thing.
And
right?
Win at the polls, you know, and organize. Yeah, right. Right. That was amazing. On January 6th, seeing that, I'm sorry, this is a total tangent, but just on January 6th, seeing on my TV, the split screen of, you know, on one half, Warnock and Ossoff winning two seats in Georgia.
Yeah.
And then
I'd forgotten that was the same day.
Yeah.
And on the other, these soccer dads falling off the walls as they're trying to climb the Capitol, right? Like the best and the worst of America on one screen. And also the right way to take power, the democratic way to, against all odds, build power, you know, and the wrong way to take power, you know, put on Viking horns and face paints. But okay. So yes, have a partner with us.
That was an important tangent though.
It was a good one. On our website, fieldteam6.org. There's one of the main menus. You can see how to partner and just click on that And if you forget everything I say, that will take you where you need to go. We also have a How to Partner meeting on Zoom once every 2 weeks, and you can find that on the website. And the ways that you can partner are the database that we have, that's our secret weapon. We want to put that at the disposal of any like-minded organization. So we already have postcarding and free BYOP texting. We call it bring your own phone. Mm-hmm. It's a platform that some of our genius volunteers developed and refined.
Wow, that's
wonderful. And we're sending over 130,000 free texts a month with it right now. So we have texting and postcarding campaigns set up in all 11 of our target states already. If an organization would like to partner with us on those, send their volunteers to those, and we can co-brand it, you know, the name of their organization also. Totally would love to do that. If they want to set up something with different targeting in a specific congressional district or their state or legislative district, however they want to do it, we can also do that. We can set up phone banks, postcarding campaigns, texting campaigns, where they want and to who they want, basically.
Nice.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, to register new Democrats.
I'm so inspired by this. And Christina, I don't know if you're thinking what I'm thinking, but we run an organization, a statewide organization in Pennsylvania, Secular Democrats of Pennsylvania. And I'm constantly pushing the door knocking model. We have endorsed candidates. You know, we're trying to establish a presence on the ground. We got a long way to go. We're trying to build our organization, trying to destigmatize secularism. There are a lot of issues we're tackling, but ultimately we're trying to be as effective as possible in 2024 and beyond. But obviously right now it's triage. We have to elect Joe Biden, and we have to elect Democrats up and down the ballot, as we've established. So I'm just thinking mechanically, your statistics are mind-blowing. I'm thinking this would be a great thing for our group, a great initiative within a swing state. So, Christine, I think we need to bring this back to our caucus.
I'm liking it. I want to unseat Scott Perry so badly.
Yeah.
I would love, like, insurrectionists need to get out of public office. And he's entrenched like a tick.
Yes, Scott Perry. He's particularly a virulent strain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of maybe organizing. That's a tough area to get people to want to door knock. We won't know who the candidate will be running against him until after our primary, which is the end of April. So I think right now there are 7 people on the ballot, 7 or 8 running against him. So a great slate of wonderful choices that.
Good to see how eager people are to get rid of him.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are several seats in Pennsylvania that do have insurrectionists that are running uncontested, which just saddens the hell out of me.
Oh, okay. We're working on it.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania is a tough nut to crack. I'm constantly grateful that this is where we live and organize, because it needs so much help. But what's really wonderful is this concept that we talk about internally all the time of not reinventing the wheel and not duplicating efforts, and where there is opportunity and good work happening and infrastructure and data, all of these things mm-hmm. that, again, just for example's sake, we as the Secular Democrats of Pennsylvania, in the caucus side of our political identity, we're not an official subsidiary of the Democratic Party. So we rely on partnerships. Usually it's campaigns, candidates. But I think this sounds, again, just speaking off the cuff, sounds like a great fit. You really piqued my curiosity. I was already curious.
That's great. We'd love to help. We'd love to set up something, you know, wherever you'd like to target. You can write the script about the issues that secular Democrats care most about, you know, that you think will appeal to people on the ground. Yeah. And I'd love to do that. We'd love to do that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We can target Christian nationalists in Lancaster, too. I mean, they just had that. They had the bomb threat. Because we had there was supposed to be a drag time story hour at the library, a wonderful event, and it was canceled because of a bomb threat.
Wow.
And instead of a wonderful performance, what those people in Lancaster retreated to were like preachers literally screaming and proselytizing in the street. So it was.
Wow. Yeah. That's helpful for kids.
Yeah.
Great. Good job. Well done, guys.
A lot of work to do here in Pennsylvania. Jason, I have a sort of a fun question. We noticed that Shepard Fairey designed some of the art for your postcards, and I wanted to know how you connect. So for those listening, this is
there
the,
it is,
the Obama
oh,
Hope
cool.
guy. Oh, that's awesome.
There's the John Lewis one right there.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that was amazing. I love him, you know, since his Hope poster for Obama, you know. Yeah. We reached out to him and someone had a contact, I guess, and or found a contact, and he was like, I'll make you eight postcard designs that you can use. Like, what? Okay, amazing.
You know, you're doing good work when
right? Yeah, it's just you know, testament to like just having the courage to reach out to someone you don't think should respond to you, you know, just in case. Sometimes they do. Super generous of them.
What does it hurt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's amazing. Jason, we can't thank you enough for your time, your expertise, and especially the important work that you're doing. You've left me, I already said I'm an optimist to begin with. You've left me feeling even more optimistic and again, grateful for all that you do and grateful now that we are having this dialogue and something, giving me some ideas to bring back the secular Dems of PA. Thank you.
That's
so
wonderful.
Much.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do. And I should answer your question, actually. And there's the last question about how to volunteer with us. Like the best way to help is volunteering and donating. And volunteering with us, just go to fieldteam6.org, go to volunteer ops under the actions menu. It's the top choice. And it's all laid out there. Every one of our events, whether it's, you know, texting, phone banking, postcarding or in-person voter drives. We have trainings online, by the way, for Pennsylvania and for every other one of our 11 target states once a month for each state, you know, state specific trainings on Zoom. It's all there. Every one of our events starts with a training. So no prior experience is necessary. Just bring yourself.
So valuable.
And it's super fun also and rewarding. We have a great crew of people there. So it's going to be a good experience. And donating, you know, the button is right on the front page at fieldteam6.org.
Yeah, remember that. $1 a voter.
$1 a voter. Everything helps. And it's my personal mission to raise that money. I bring all the fundraising prowess of a lifelong TV writer to bear. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. That's not much, but I'm learning. I'm learning as we go. And it could not be a more important mission. Every dollar helps us get the word out to more people and register more people.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, thank you again. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for organizing in Pennsylvania.
Thank you so much for checking out our conversation with Jason Berlin. I know that I'm one of those intrinsically optimistic people, but it's work like Jason's and that of the countless volunteers across the nation supporting Field Team 6 that provides a strong foundation for my positive outlook. So definitely go show them some love. Make a donation. It's hard to argue with their success rate. But while you're at it, consider making a matched contribution to Unreasonable. If you appreciate our mission to collate inspiring interviews about or adjacent to the subject of church-state separation, which we carefully distill into tangible action items for you to take in your community, please support us on Patreon. Visit podcastunreasonable.com for a link to our Patreon page. Meanwhile, follow us on the platform formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. Like us, love us, write glowing reviews on our podcast page, reach out to us, and most importantly, if you like what we're doing, please tell your friends. Help us build this network. I'm your host, David Brown, joined by my co-host, Christina Iacono. Our executive producer is Bennett Windheim. Our audio producer is Glenn Yanaro. Our theme music is my own composition with me playing violins, viola, and cello, and that's my mom, Jody Brown, on piano. On behalf of our whole team, stay vigilant, stay active, and let's be reasonable.